This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. And here are some of the stories making global news headlines today. The United Arab Emirates was the target of cyber attacks after establishing formal ties with Israel, the Gulf Arab state's cyber security head said on Sunday. The UAE in August broke with decades of Arab policy when it agreed to forge ties with Israel in a move that angered Palestinians and some Muslim states. Bahrain and Sudan have followed suit. Venezuelans on Sunday choose a new Congress in an election that the opposition is boycotting, and most Western nations call this a fraud by President Nicolas Maduro to retake the last state institution not in the hands of the ruling Socialist Party. The vote is almost certain to return Congress to Maduro's allies, despite his government struggling with an economy in ruins, aggressive U.S. sanctions that stifle the nation's oil exports, and the migration of some 5 million citizens. Former Hong Kong lawmaker Ted Hui said Sunday that his local bank accounts appear to have been frozen after he said he would seek exile in Britain to continue his pro-democratic activities. Hui told Reuters via WhatsApp that the bank accounts belonging to him, his wife, and his parents in Bank of China Hong Kong, HSBC, and Hang Seng Bank were frozen. He gave no further details. Japan, France, and the United States will hold joint military drills on land and sea for the first time in May next year as the Chinese military steps up activity in the region. A Japanese newspaper said on Sunday the exercises conducted on one of Japan's uninhabited outlying islands will focus on providing relief efforts during a natural disaster, but parts could also form the basis for a defense against attack, the paper said, without citing sources. This is VOA News. Thousands of supporters of incoming Moldovan President Maia Sandu rallied in the capital city on Sunday. They want a snap parliamentary election, accusing parliament of trying to sabotage her ability to fight corruption. Sandu is a former World Bank economist who favors closer ties with the European Union. She defeated the pro-Moscow incumbent Igor Dodon in a runoff vote last month, but will share power with a parliament and government run by lawmakers aligned with him. The Eastern European country of 3.5 million, where the West and Russia vie for influence, has been rocked in recent years by instability and corruption scandals, including the disappearance of $1 billion from the banking system. Sandu's supporters protested against Parliament on Thursday, hastily pushing through a law to strip her of control of the intelligence service. The move was backed by the Socialist Party, which Dodon used to lead and is the largest in Parliament, and the party of Ilan Shor, a businessman convicted of fraud and money laundering in connection to the $1 billion bank scandal. Sandu told reporters Sunday, quote, "We will go to the end until we cleanse the country of corrupt officials." Romanians began voting in parliamentary elections on Sunday with the governing pro-European liberals tipped to win, despite criticism for their handling of the coronavirus pandemic. The first official results are expected later in the evening. The vote has been organized to take in the now familiar virus safety measures of social distancing, mask wearing, and hand disinfectant. In a region where populists and nationalists have recently gained ground, Liberal Prime Minister Ludovic Orban has pledged to modernize one of the EU's poorest countries and keep it on a pro-European path. Orban has been running a minority government for the past year. Both the virus and widespread disillusionment with politics are expected to affect turnout. And some other news headlines. Kuwait's opposition takes nearly half of parliament's seat in weekend polls as critics call for reforms over corruption and high debt, but the sole female lawmaker loses her seat. An influential Saudi prince launches a bitter attack on Israel at a regional conference, drawing retorts from the Jewish state's foreign minister, who addresses the gathering virtually. And Liberians vote Tuesday in a referendum on shortening presidential terms, a change some members of the opposition fear the current president will exploit to extend his stay in office. For more on these and other news stories, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
Our transparency and the transparent processes that we have, you know, we provide comfort to the citizenry at all levels that, you know, how the elections would go. But I like to assure them that we would provide and we would declare results that are based on the will of the people.
The Electoral Commission of Ghana plans to release the outcome of the elections 24 hours after polls close.
We believe that our demand is consistent with democratic principles. We believe that we are right in asking him to stand down and to facilitate our economic welfare. There's really no point in continuing to tolerate a president who really doesn't care enough. And that is basically what the issue is all about.
The Northern Elders Forum demands the resignation of Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari.
We note that violence may have disrupted WFP's existing operations in Tigray. We also note that it may have created new numbers of people in need of support. WFP is ready to respond to increased caseloads of people in need in Tigray as soon as needs are assessed.
And United Nations agencies say they cannot help thousands of civilians until Ethiopia opens a humanitarian corridor. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The chairperson of the Electoral Commission of Ghana says her organization plans to declare the outcome of the general election 24 hours after the polls close. Attorney Jean Adukwe Mensah also says the electoral body has implemented new strategic mechanisms to ensure transparency in the entire voting process. But critics say the commission could be making a costly error by rushing to announce the winner of the presidential vote 24 hours after polls close. Ghanaians will choose a new president and parliament on Monday. Incumbent President Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo faces main opposition leader and former President John Dramani Mahama in what is a rerun of the elections 4 years ago. Analysts say the vote could be too close to call, although recent polls show a slight advantage for the president. In part two of my interview with attorney Jean Adukwe Mensah, chairperson of the Electoral Commission of Ghana, she talks about the electoral body's plans to declare the outcome of Monday's vote within hours after the polls close. Madam Chairperson, you told Ghanaians that within 24 hours after the elections are held on December 7, the Electoral Commission has put in measures to declare the result. Some people are saying this is obviously overly ambitious. Some people are doubtful. Tell us, why do you think this is possible? And what specific mechanisms have you implemented to ensure your high expectations? Because this is not the first time Ghana has organized elections, and sometimes it takes a few more days to declare the result. What is going to be different?
I can understand the apprehension, because I'm sure people are wondering what methods. And the methods have not changed. We're using the good old fax and complementing it with emails, of course, built encrypted emails and secure lines and so on. What has changed is the efficiency that we've built into the process and the training we've afforded all our staff, right from the polling station to the region. And therefore, we all have that desire. We have a plan ahead of us. We have a strategy. And we all have to, you know, move the part of the wheel to ensure that this happens. So it's really just the efficiency that we've built into the processes. What we are saying is that, you know, one should be able to have the results some 6-7 hours after the election. And if you have it, why keep it?
Madam Chairperson, there have been instances of rejected ballots over the years. This time around, what measures have you put in place to make sure that this situation is drastically reduced?
You know, as a commission, we spent some time reflecting on this, and we realized that the biggest challenge and what causes rejected ballots is that the design of the ballots do not provide sufficient space, enough space for people to thumbprint without it going into the next box. And to think that, you know, just with, you know, a slight, you know, stamp printing into the next box, you find a lot of rejected ballots. And we felt that, well, let's look at the design of the ballots. And we, as a commission, we looked at this and we redesigned it, creating wide spaces, black, thick black spaces between each of the candidates on the ballot, making it impossible for, you know, anybody to thumbprint and for that print to go into the next box. And I think this has been the innovation. I think this is innovative. We believe that even where you thumbprint and it goes, you know, because of that black lines in between the candidates, it's very unlikely that it will go into the next box. So we believe that this will go a long way to reducing rejected ballots. And so we do not envisage that we'll be seeing, you know, rejected ballots.
Some political parties have expressed concern about some processes that you've put in place, but how do you allay their fear?
We operate within the confines of the Constitution and our various CIs that govern our operations. And therefore, for this election, we are operating under the CI, the Constitutional Instrument 127. What we've done is to try to engage our political parties at the level of the Inter-Party Advisory Committee, and there we try to build consensus on some of the issues and, you know, respond to the concerns of parties. So I think we've tried to do that over the year and in previous years as well. I must say that it has not always been easy to build consensus on all the issues, but in most of the time we have the majority of political parties supporting the decisions of the commission. Interestingly, in the last two IPAC meetings, we've had the two major parties, you know, building consensus on some of the issues, sometimes even against the commission.
What is your message to the people of Ghana?
Well, I like to assure them that on the part of the Electoral Commission, you know, our processes will be transparent, fair, and credible. We've built these mechanisms and these processes into our operations. We would, you know, our teams are out there to work to ensure that it is the will of the people that stands at the end of the day. They've been provided with adequate training. On our part as commissioners as well, we are assuring the citizenry that we would declare the results based on the will of the people. Our transparency and the transparent processes that we have, you know, we provide comfort to the citizenry at all levels that, you know, how the elections would go. But I like to assure them that we would provide and we would declare results that are based on the will of the people.
Attorney Jean Adukwe Mensah is chairperson of the Electoral Commission of Ghana. She spoke with me from the capital, Accra. In Nigeria, the Northern Elders Forum, a nonpartisan political pressure group, is calling on President Muhammadu Buhari to step down. The group accuses him of failing to carry out his core constitutional duty to protect life and property of citizens. The call follows reports of a surge in violence and insecurity, including abductions and killings across parts of the country's north. The group's demands come after militant insurgent group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for killing 76 farm workers outside Borno State's capital, Maiduguri, in northern Nigeria. Officials say the fight against militant groups, including Boko Haram, will continue. This after condemning the killings and promising to deal with those responsible for the attacks. To learn more about the call for the president's resignation, I reached Dr. Hakim Baba Ahmed, spokesperson for the Northern Elders Forum.
Before President Buhari defeated President Jonathan, he told President Jonathan, stand down, resign, because you are incapable of running this country. And now we are talking about 5-6 years, and the situation under President Buhari is considerably worse than it was under President Jonathan. Nigeria has never been more insecure. In the north, we're dealing with killings from all over the place. The insurgency the president promised to defeat is still alive. It just a few days ago, he slaughtered dozens of our fellow citizens. There are bandits running wild in the north. There are kidnappers all over the place. We've never been more insecure. And all we hear are excuses and explanations we're tired of. And so we restrained ourselves. We held back from telling the president what he finally needs to hear, that as an elected person who has the trust of the people to secure them, he has failed to do that. The only option left is to tell him, Mr. President, resign. That is what happens in civilized countries, in countries where leaders are accountable. If you fail to perform what you swear to do, what the people expect you to do, you stand down. That is basically what we did. We exercised a democratic right to tell a president who was elected to perform certain jobs that he has failed to do so, and therefore it is time for him to go.
But Dr. Hakim, officials of the government have said repeatedly that the government has put in measures. They stepped up security patrols. The army has been emboldened. The other security agencies, including the police, are doing as much as they can to protect civilians. You don't think this is enough?
Well, obviously, it's not enough. We've had these excuses multiple times. Every time we suffer setbacks in the fight against insurgency, we suffer setbacks against bandits and kidnappers and sundry crimes, the president says, I've given the military and the security agencies all the support they need. I've told them to improve the way they do that. And the situation keeps getting worse. How can citizens show faith and trust the president? He doesn't even change his rhetorics. He doesn't even change his excuses for failure. He doesn't change anything at all. He doesn't change the people he has trusted to protect us. He doesn't change the strategy. He doesn't even question their capacities. Certainly, we don't see any evidence on the part of the president or on the part of the people that he has trusted to secure us that he intends to change anything. This is a president who is extremely reluctant and resistant to change. Now, if he cannot change himself and he cannot change the pattern of his leadership, then the country obviously needs to change him. It's as simple as that. From Zamfara to Akwa Ibom, Nigerians are dying. We are tired. We've had enough. And it is time to tell those that we have elected and entrusted with the responsibility to protect us, enough is enough. We can't die. We'll continue to die the way we're dying. It's not good enough. We are tired of hearing these tired excuses. They don't make any difference in the manner in which government undertakes its responsibilities.
Well, Dr. Hakim, some people are saying you're giving up on your own King up north. You supported him wholeheartedly in the first round of election. He has won re-election because of his commitment in the fight against Boko Haram and other insurgent groups. Why now? Why are you kicking against him? And do you think the call for him to resign will be adhered to?
We elected him on the basis of trust and faith that he was going to deliver. He was going to improve the security of the country. He was going to fight corruption. He was going to improve the economy. And we have no reason to apologize for electing him on both occasions. And we have no reason for apologizing for asking him to stand down now. The same democratic right we exercised to elect him, believing that on both occasions, the first time we would say he didn't have enough time to fix those things that he wanted to fix. When, after 4 years, he didn't deliver, we said, let's give him another chance. There's no reason why the North should feel apologetic or feel bad about electing him. But by the same token, we don't need to feel bad for asking him at this stage, sorry, Mr. President, we trusted you twice. We elected you in 2015 and we elected you in 2019. You haven't delivered. There's no sign that you will deliver. And therefore, we think that it's time for you to go. There's no reason why anybody should feel that. He's not a northern president. He's a Nigerian president. And it's not just northerners who are asking for him to go. It's the whole country. He has failed the whole country, but he has particularly and rather regretfully failed northerners, because northerners have paid a much, much higher price for his presidency than other Nigerians. We know how much we are bleeding from this presidency, and it's sad. It's regretful, but we've learned a lesson now. We will continue to raise our voices. We know that we have the support of Nigerians. We believe that we've exercised a responsible position. We have restrained ourselves from commenting at this level. And we believe that our demand is consistent with democratic principles. We believe that we are right in asking him to stand down and to facilitate our economic welfare. There's really no point in continuing to tolerate a president who really doesn't care enough. And that is basically what the issue is all about.
Dr. Hakim Baba Hamed is the spokesperson for the Northern Elders Forum. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. United Nations agencies say they cannot help tens of thousands of civilians suffering because of the Tigray conflict until Ethiopia opens a humanitarian corridor to allow aid into the region. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The United Nations in Ethiopia reached an agreement Wednesday to grant aid agencies unimpeded access to the beleaguered area. It is yet to be implemented, though, and the hoped-for humanitarian corridor to Tigray opened. The World Health Organization says its staff is on standby and ready to be deployed as soon as the situation permits. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says health services have been disrupted by the conflict.
That will impact programs of immunization, of disease control, surveillance, and other issues. So it is really important as soon as the access is there to bring in those necessary drugs, not only for communicable but also for non-communicable diseases, and restore health services.
The WHO warns the coronavirus pandemic and increased communicable diseases such as malaria will have a serious impact on the health of Tigray's population. The agency says it has sent emergency health supplies to treat 10,000 patients for 3 months. Jazarevich says the WHO also has pre-positioned additional supplies for trauma, cholera, malaria, and severe acute malnutrition in bordering states. He says these materials are ready to be dispatched to Tigray as soon as the humanitarian corridor is opened. Prior to the fighting, the World Food Program had been providing food aid to 1 million people in Tigray. WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says the UN estimates at least double that number now will need aid.
We note that violence may have disrupted WFP's existing operations in Tigray. We also note that it may have created new numbers of people in need of support. WFP is ready to respond to increased caseloads of people in need in Tigray as soon as needs are assessed.
The Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says operational, logistical, and security issues in the UN-Ethiopian agreement still must be worked out. Once they are resolved and aid can flow freely to Tigray, it says humanitarian operations will be able to move ahead at full speed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new report from the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, says the well-being of children in sub-Saharan Africa is under siege from all directions since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. The region is now suffering an economic recession, and UNICEF says that has pushed about 50 million people into extreme poverty. The majority of them are children. For VOA, Mavis Ochery has more from Joasso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
UNICEF says there now are likely more than 500 million people living in extreme poverty in sub-Saharan Africa. That is nearly double the number in 1990 when progress against the Millennium Development Goals started to be measured. The region's 550 million children already face many challenges, but the pandemic has intensified those problems and created new ones. Matthew Kamis is the UNICEF Social Policy Regional Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa based in Nairobi. He says UNICEF's latest reports show that COVID-19 has been a catastrophe for children in Africa and recommends a massive international plan to turn things around, including the use of cash transfers to families. He says 4 out of 5 children in the region suffer from what's called multidimensional poverty. They are unable to access basic social amenities like clean water, health facilities, and a decent place of accommodation. Around 35 million children were out of school, although governments have tried to expand remote learning, and 280 million face food insecurity.
Since then, children have been battered by a long list of new challenges. We've just, for example, gone through the most severe economic shock in history, which has led to the biggest increase in extreme poverty in sub-Saharan Africa ever recorded. Beyond that, we can look at all of the other COVID-19 related side effects. That's rising prices of basic things like food, water, transportation, medical supplies, and
Kamis say the region had expected 1.6% economic growth this year before the pandemic. Now, there are predictions sub-Saharan nations will see their economies contract by 1.6%. In some countries, such as Nigeria and South Africa, the International Monetary Fund expects growth to fall by 5% or more. He says looking at some of the extreme cases in Burundi and the Republic of Congo, their average per capita income in 2020 is lower than at any point in the past 40 years. The pandemic comes on top of droughts, floods, locust invasions, and conflicts.
Intensifying conflicts, we can look to Mozambique, Ethiopia, South Sudan, many parts of the Sahel right now. The big takeaway is that this generation of young persons was in a very bad place before 2020, and they have been undergoing a series of very intense blows, which has led to, you know, really staggering losses of human capital, education, and nutrition. And we know that all of this will also impact not just children's, but this is also a huge impact on economic development and overall potential of the region.
Kami say giving cash to households could mitigate most of the challenges facing children, and it will boost economic growth, build social protection systems, and future resilience to shocks. He said it would achieve big cost saving over time. He says UNICEF and some governments in the region have worked together to test cash transfer programs and have documented the benefits. He says many governments put cash transfers at the center of their crisis response this year. But in sub-Saharan Africa, expanded programs reach only 15% of the population, leaving millions without help to reach them. Governments need donor aid.
We also advocate for a minimum of 6 months of emergency cash support, but ideally it would be 12 months or longer, recognizing that the longer these programs are sustained, the bigger the benefits. In terms of the cost, if we were to operationalize this program across all of sub-Saharan Africa, we're talking somewhere around $50 billion. That's about the same amount of foreign aid that was flowing into sub-Saharan Africa before the crisis.
Can we say cash transfer programs could increase per capita economic growth by around 5% on average, which could push most countries in the region back on a positive track? Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
Mali's iconic Bamako Hippodrome has reopened its traditional horse races on Sundays after months of being closed due to COVID-19. Horses are ingrained in Mali's culture, and the youth flock to the races in droves. For VOA, Annie Reisenberg reports from the Malian capital, Bamako.
Every Sunday since 1946, spectators have flocked to the racetrack in Bamako's Hippodrome neighborhood, named after the track itself, to watch the horses run. Mahamadou Tangara was one of those spectators as a child. Now a professional jockey, he has won numerous championships and represented Mali in races abroad. Speaking from one of the stables beside the racetrack, which is on one of Bamako's main thoroughfares, Tangara explains the moment he decided to pursue this dream. He says he saw the great jockeys, how they raced their horses. So since that day, I decided, he says, that one day in the future, I'm going to be a jockey. The various empires that ruled Mali throughout its history depended on horses for transport and for the strength of their armies. Under French colonial rule, horse racing around a circular track was brought to Mali in the early 1900s. Mamadou Diarra speaks about the history of horses in Mali from the office of the Malian Federation of Equestrian Sports, where he serves as a general commissioner. He says there are so many cultural manifestations that are done by horse or around horses. Even in the past, he says, during the pre-colonial period, the power of an army was measured by its number of cavalry. In March, the races at Hippodrome were abruptly stopped due to COVID-19. For jockeys like Tangara, this meant a complete loss of income. On any given Sunday, a jockey can win between $91 and $182 in prize money. All I felt was difficulty, Tangara says. Just hard times, because he says, if we work, we win something. He says, if we don't work, we win nothing. So, We had 8 months where we didn't work. The races started up again on November 15th, and immediately, the sport's large, loyal audience returned to the track, where horses and excited audience members alike kick up the red dust. Before a race, Yakuba Donsoko, a sports journalist and race announcer, speaks near the racetrack about the importance of these races to the Malian public. He says equestrian sports play this main role in terms of the public who attend different activities. It's huge, he says. For my part, he says, I will say that in terms of the audience, it's number one. But soon after the races were reopened, COVID-19 cases again rose sharply in Mali. Some of the jockeys and the organizers wear masks, but most of the audience is indifferent to COVID precautions. Officials are now discussing new COVID-19 countermeasures, which could include shutting down the races. The jockeys would lose their livelihood again, but Donsoko says the community is ready to accept another shutdown if it will save lives. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, the government of Zimbabwe is working to improve its food insecurity situation. Part of this has been pushing to improve the utilization of land given to black farmers in 2000 under the controversial land reform program. For VOA, Kutsai Zwanavashi has more from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Speaking at a grain marketing board function recently, Minister of Midlands Provincial Affairs, Larima Vima, urged people to make use of the land they received from the land reform program.
The Second Republic's mantra is production, production, and more production. If you have land, especially those that have been allocated land, you must use it productively. If you can't produce, at least produce for your family, your own food security at household level. Because what it means is that that's one less family the government has to worry about.
This comes as local media report the government will be taking back some of the land that's not being used productively. John Basera, the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Agriculture, explains the program.
Not eviction, it's downsizing. We are going to downsize. Obviously, let's say you have 1,000 hectares and you are using 5. We'll leave you with your 5. What we want is maximum land utilization.
Dr. Enchas Masuga is the Minister of Agriculture, and he explains which land is being seized.
The first category is multiple farm ownership. The second is abandoned farms. The third is derelict farms. The fourth is underutilized farms. And fifth is productive farms. We say all productive farms will be left for now as we move to assure this nation of increased productivity. However, those that fall into the categories of multiple farm ownership, abandoned farms, underutilized and derelict will have those properties being the subject of visits with a view to reorganizing and giving the many Zimbabweans that are on the waiting list for land.
Clarice Maduhu is a political analyst and says it helps that the government is acting transparently on this effort, and that could help it succeed.
There has been a lot of things that have been happening unreported. I think we are now beginning to get more serious issues because these things are being reported and that the public is now aware of their rights.
While it is still early to tell how much land will be seized, more than 4,000 white farmers lost their farms in the land reform program in 2000. Those currently holding the land, seized 20 years ago, may be the biggest losers if it falls in some of the categories mentioned by Masuga. However, analysts say if the plan is rolled out transparently, some Zimbabweans on the waiting list for land stand to benefit. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zwinavashe from Harare.
Meanwhile, the Zimbabwean government says it has spent more than $70 million importing public buses and delivery trucks over the last 2 years. This comes despite efforts to support domestic manufacturers to help ease the country's economic woes and hold on to scant foreign exchange. For VOA, Ade Gondo gives us more on the story from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The details came in the government's new five-year economic blueprint that was released this week. It says local vehicle manufacturing companies such as Willowvale have underutilized capacity, which can competitively produce 65 such buses and 100 delivery trucks per month with a local content of over 50%. Economic analyst Felix Chari was skeptical.
Most of these vehicle manufacturers will be engaged this for the first time. As a result, they lack skilled and qualified personnel. Moreover, they are faced with the high production costs as they will rely on foreign body parts suppliers.
Early this month, the government imported 50 Golden Dragon buses from China, raising the total from China and Belarus to 300 buses over the past 12 months at an estimated cost of $50,000 each. Observers say government actions run contrary to public professions by officials such as the Minister of Industry and Commerce, Sekai Nzenza, to revive local manufacturing of buses and trucks. Economic analyst Reginald Shoko raised his eyebrows over the US $70 million price tag.
It's a worrying trend because we will have expected that money to be used for local industry to capacitate our local car manufacturing industry. We have a plant that is able to manufacture buses in Matare. But at the same time, we have to also understand and appreciate the fact that these are loans that government have to pay in the long run. The biggest challenge is around the transparency of such loans. Who is really behind the buses? Who really is buying the buses? And what profit is he buying the buses? How much is he buying the unit? How much is he then onward selling to Zimbabwe? These are challenges and questions that we find ourselves needing answers, especially in these very desperate times.
Economic analyst Prosper Chitambara agrees that policies need to be matched by actions, but thinks imports are inevitable amid questions of quality and allegations of profiteering in government procurements.
Even once we start manufacturing our own local buses, I think the capacity may still not be up to very high standards to really meet the demand on the ground. There will continue to be a need for supplementing local capacity with imports, but obviously the view of gradually phasing out those imports as we build a local capacity.
Experts say local assembly and manufacture will prove daunting because of the weak local currency. They also say the country's tax regime is one of the highest in the world, making local vehicles less competitive. Reporting for VOA, this is Ade Gondo in Bulawayo.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. African Champions League 2020-2021 kicked off last week as last year's winners were crowned with Al Ahly beating Egyptian rivals Zamalek 2-1. South African giants Kaizer Chiefs made a winning return to the league by beating PW Bamenda 1-0 in Cameroon. Back-to-back champions Enyimba of Nigeria also beat Rahimo of Burkina Faso 1-0. Plateau United, the other Nigerian challengers, lost 1-0 at home in Jos to Simba of Tanzania. Al Hilal of Sudan beat Vipers of Uganda 1-0 in Entebbe, while CS Sfaxien of Tunisia trounced Malandege of Zanzibar 5-0 on the Indian Ocean island off the coast of Tanzania. APR of Rwanda beat Gor Mahia of Kenya 2-1. There are also walkovers for Al Ahly Benghazi of Libya and Gazelle of Chad. And Uganda beat Tanzania 4-1 to win the SEKAFA Under-20 title. Both teams now qualify for the Under-20 Africa Cup of Nations 2021 in Mauritania. The final played in Arusha saw Uganda revenge after Tanzania won the same title in Jinja, Uganda last year. South Sudan finished third after beating Kenya 2-1 earlier on Wednesday. Tanzania midfielder Pascal Msindo was named the tournament's most valued player, while Ivan Bogere of Uganda and Abdul Suleiman of Tanzania finished as co-top scorers with 5 goals each. And in athletics, world record holders Amanda Duplantis and Yulma Rojas have been named Male and Female Athletes of the Year at the World Athletics Awards. In an unbeaten season, Swedish pole vaulter Duplantis set an indoor world record of 6.18 meters and an outdoor record of 6.15 meters, the latter clearance breaking Sergey Bucco's 26-year-old record. Venezuelan triple jumper Rojas set a new indoor record of 15.43 meters this year, breaking a mark that had lasted 21 years. And in boxing, world heavyweight champion Anthony Joshua will defend his titles against mandatory challenger Bulgarian Kubrat Pulev on December 12th at Wembley Arena. Great Britain's Joshua holds the IBF, WBA, WBO and IBO world titles. Up to 1,000 fans will be allowed in the arena to watch the fight. Joshua was due to fight the 39-year-old in June, but it was postponed because of the coronavirus pandemic. The 31-year-old Joshua has not fought since last December, when he beat Andy Ruiz Jr. in a rematch in Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, Pulev has suffered just one defeat in 29 fights during an 11-year professional career. That was a fifth-round knockout inflicted by Vladimir Klitschko in November of 2014. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Poteza furaha, amani sina tena,
sina tena.
Masikini penzi langu, kazima nyota ya jaa, kanimwaga kanitema. Naishi kwa kutapatapa, anajifanya oni. Chanzo yeye, ananizingua, nakaribia kudata. Yamenifika shingoni, arudi japo nipone ugua au tatizo misina. Yani misina, kachotaka nini mina, nimechacha nimechina.
Sherehe kwa madufu, ona kakivunja kibubu. Ah, mina teketea, sauti yake ya kasuku. Yanijia huku na huku, nikizivuta kumbu kumbu. Ah, zina nirudia, nalikumbuka tujina. Ameumiza mutima, akalimua na shina. Ho, jamani,
nishipo kutapatapa. Anajifanya oni, chanzo yeye, ananizingua, nakaribia kudata. Yamenifika shingoni, arudi japo nipone ugua au tatizo misina. Yani misina, kachotaka nini.
We're gonna make it. profit. Get them got it in a waist and pocket. And if it's chatty chatty, then bring our head out and suck it. Oh, but no violence for the right, so no loose stick, no beef, watching back bite, just so. No bad money, cause we no live dirty life, just so. They looking down at us, now they see what we become. Talk on me a fool, when I whisper to your lips. Nobody come, no way.
Thank you.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Zaida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a wise man cannot save a decaying country as manure cannot save an eroding land. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Good evening, Africa.